Welcome to the Jay Martin Show, where we dissect the great minds of geopolitics and finance so that we can understand the world better. My guest today is Brandon Weikert. He's a best-selling author and a geopolitical analyst. We cover a ton of ground. We spend a lot of time focused on one subject, which if you're a regular listener, you've probably noticed, I'm trying to get as many perspectives as possible these days on the power balance between the United States and China. And this means dissecting each innovation sector, education sector, demographic challenges, debt challenges, military developments, and most importantly, from my perspective, geopolitical alliances, specifically with countries who possess the raw materials that we all need. Those are typically the winning alliances. Those are what wars are fought over and what wars are won with. So definitely spent a lot of time chatting with Brandon today and some interesting takes that I haven't heard before. So I hope you enjoy this. We also talked about the future of cybersecurity and why it's totally different this time. When I think about, a cyber hack, right? I think about my identity being stolen or credit card fraud or maybe a bank account, something like this. Obviously, as we continue to digitize all aspects of our economies, our water systems, our energy grids, our transportation systems all become super vulnerable. And Brandon spent a lot of time covering the war in space, which doesn't get a lot of press because the press loves to cover things that bleed, right? If it bleeds, it leads. And warfare in outer space, satellite warfare, although it's been occurring for 8 to 10 years, rarely gets mentioned at all in the press, which is kind of crazy because it's a really big thing. So Brandon's been spending a lot of time following those stories. So we talk about that as well today. As always, if you enjoy my content, I write a weekly essay every Sunday morning. There's a link beneath this podcast in the show notes where you can subscribe. Love you to join the team, 40,000 investors every Sunday. It's lovely. And here is Brandon Weikert. Enjoy. All right, here I am with Brandon Weikert. Brandon, thank you for coming on the show. I'm looking forward to chatting with you.
Thank you for having me. It's a joy to be here.
All right. There's a ton of ground I want to cover. And here's where I want to start. I've heard you say some super interesting things about the future of cyber attacks. I want to start here because when I think about cyber attacks, I think about, data breaches or identity theft and things like this. But as we continue to digitize more of our critical national infrastructure, right, like water services and supply, energy grids, transportation services, all of these things become vulnerable. So from your perspective, how has the idea of a cyber attack changed and how might it change in our near future?
Well, as you rightly note, we've basically been handing over more and more of our civilian and military functions to the cyber domain. And now with AI, we're going to start probably having more of that happening with increasing complexity. And what that means is convenience. Yes, we'll have a lot more conveniences in our daily lives, most likely. But it also means that there are critical vulnerabilities in ways that previous generations never had to worry about with their infrastructure. Enemies like North Korea can now suddenly do a lot of damage to infrastructure in America that was once, you had to physically be there to do the damage. And I think that this year in particular, I was on another show, and I said, if we are going to see like a cyber 9/11 event, it's probably going to be in 2024. Because it's sort of the perfect storm where we've spent 20 years handing off a lot of our critical functions into the cyber domain, which are not well defended, usually. Also, it's the geopolitical perfect storm going on globally where you've got China pushing hard against its neighbors. You've got North Korea, South Korea. You've got Venezuela and Guyana. You've got the issues in the Middle East. And then you've got, of course, Russia and Ukraine. And then internally as well, you have a lot of discord here in the United States between Americans as we go into this November election. And so it's sort of the perfect moment for any kind of cyber threat actor to initiate a major catastrophic cyber attack.
So interesting. I was going to ask you, is it realistic to assume in, our lifetime we'll experience some kind of a nationwide cyber attack that does paralyze key points of our economy, right? And you maybe jump there and you're like, yeah, and it probably a lot sooner than that. Probably 2024 is a pretty optimal time.
Yeah, if we're talking about like a man-made purposeful attack, Yeah, I think it's probably going to be now, because if they wait till, I mean, of course, the threat's going to always be there from here on out. But if you're a foreign actor and you want to disrupt the Americans, now's the time to do it. If, you know, we're also going to have to worry going forward about technical, you know, problems, you know, mistakes that happen in an increasingly complex system. You know, you could have human error that could do a lot of damage as well. But right now, the concern for me is less that and more of a malicious actor, either internally or foreign, you know, externally, doing something in the here and now to really mess us up.
So when you think about the balance of defense versus offense, I mean, as you mentioned, these systems are evolving digitally faster than our defense capabilities for right. them might be, right? And maybe the offense, right, coming from somewhere else is maturing faster. And before I hit record, we were chatting about a mutual friend of ours, Elbridge Colby, and had him on the show recently. And one truth we landed on, we agreed on a bunch, disagreed on a bunch, but where we landed was there's some universal laws of nature that apply to us as, you know, people, governments, and countries. And that is that, number one, weakness invites aggression. Yeah. And number two, strength discourages conflict. So I think about our digital infrastructure through that lens. Do we look weak and therefore open to an attack? Or right. are we positioned in such a way that our strength would discourage North Korea from ever trying to actually infiltrate in a seriously meaningful way? I mean, because there's been some shots fired, right? Little things like... Right. European Parliament website was taken down in 2022 mm-hmm. for a matter of hours. And, you know, a pro-Kremlin group raised their hand and said that was us. But it wasn't really, it was a couple hours and it was a website, right? But it was right. a bit of a warning shot. Like, we can't do this. Right. But what's your take on that concept?
I think that there's two issues here. And I don't know how political you want to get, but I do think leadership matters. And I think right now the United States has not led very well. And I think that whether you are a supporter of Joe Biden or not, he comes across as sort of an American Chernenko. And if you remember Chernenko back in the Soviet days, he was the premier right before Gorbachev. People viewed him dismissively. It's one of the reasons why the Chinese really turned their backs on their communist allies in the Soviet Union, was they thought they were weak. And I think something similar is happening, whether we actually are weak or not is a matter of debate. But our leadership appears to be weak, and that invites aggression from abroad. And right now, one of the areas where these foreign threat actors like North Korea, which otherwise really can't take us on in a fair fight, one of the areas where they think they have some equality with us is in the cyber domain. And that's a relatively low barrier of entry for them to do maximum amount of damage. And they can do it on the cheap, and it's very expensive and damaging to us. And so you have not just these Russia and China type actors, but you've got rogue states really heavily invested in the cyber capability realm, because they know that they can really pack quite a wallop in ways that their other forces in other domains cannot do. And so I think that our exhibition of weakness in leadership invites the kind of challenge that we're seeing from abroad. And those challengers very often are looking to use cyber because it's the lowest barrier of entry for them.
And Chernenko died while he was in office, correct?
Yes, and I'm not trying to say that that's going to happen with Biden. I hope that happens with Biden, but there is a parallel there.
All right, that's not what I was trying to, but good catch. Yeah, there was a string of Russian leaders that were kind of old and decrepit, and I think it was it Reagan who was asked, why don't you have a serious conversation with your Soviet counterpart? Yeah. And his response was, well, they keep dying on me, right? On me. Yeah. Until Gorbachev, yeah. That was the case right. for two right. or three in a row. All right, last question on this. I wanna kind of make this concept real for myself and my audience a little bit. And we think through, what would the implications of a cyber attack be? You know, what infrastructure is vulnerable? And I promise I'm not projecting doom porn. I don't do that. But I do like to understand the potential realities that we're faced with. And so that's where this question comes from. You know, what is vulnerable, Brandon? What would you expect as an attack right. vector?
Well, so you've got multiple actors with multiple objectives and mission sets, ranging from, as you noted, the website example, sort of, you know, the equivalent of defacing public property to make a point. It's a nuisance. It's not going to be the end of the world, though. But then you've also got those mission sets and those threat actors who want to end the country's existence or want to degrade our ability to operate globally. And so they're going to target things like our banking sector. They're going to target things like our water treatment facilities, things like our, you know, sewage and things like that. Our electrical grid is a big target. In fact, I think it was back when I was living in Chicago, back in 2009, 2010. That was when Iran did a massive attack on, I cannot remember the bank. They did a massive attack on an American bank. They also, that around that time period, did a massive cyber attack on a dam in New York, upstate New York, in which they basically tried to flood it. And it did create a flood. And that was a proof of concept, I believe, for the Iranians. And the North Koreans have similar capabilities. Recently, we've seen odd things happening on some American bases with electrical infrastructure. I was recently with a group of F-35 pilots, and I directly asked them if, because they were going on about how the F-35 is basically a flying computer chip and it requires all of these, you know, inputs. And I said, you know, has there ever been an instance of a cyber attack? Has anybody ever tried to hack the F-35? And of course, they gave me the stock answer officially that if they knew about it, they couldn't talk about it. But there was an incident in South Carolina not long ago in which an F-35 basically crash landed. I have heard from people that the onboard operating system had been hacked. And so now that was never confirmed, but that is what I have heard. And so you really have a kind of a panoply of options. If you're a foreign threat actor, ranging from, you know, just public defacement and nuisance all the way up to critical infrastructure being ended. And it really isn't that hard for them to do it. Something that James Mann wrote about in 2007 in his book, The China Fantasy. Back in 2005 to 2007, Chinese hackers were already embedding themselves in our critical water infrastructure for civilian use. And they were basically mapping all of our networks and looking for weak points to exploit at a later date. And that is exactly what has been going on for about 20 years now with many of our rivals. And they're going into systems that usually aren't regularly updated. And they're aware of sort of these weak points that we aren't necessarily aware of. And so I would be very concerned. You could, if a major war breaks out, which I think is coming, one of the first areas that our enemies are going to hit is going to be our cyber infrastructure. And no matter how great, we've got some really wonderful people who do cybersecurity in the United States, particularly at NSA, no matter how great they are, the enemy's only got to get it right one time. Back in 2019, and I'll just finish here with this. Back in 2019, I was asked to partake in a closed briefing with U.S. Cyber Command. And during the Q&A session, I had brought up the possibility of a new Cold War. And the head of Cyber Command at the time looked at me and he said, he goes, Cold War? He goes, son, every day I go into the office, my team and I are engaged in a hot war with our enemies. He goes, it's not a Cold War at all for us. And so, and that was back in 2019. So, you know, it's only gotten worse.
You remind me of, you know, I mentioned I had General Wesley Clark on the show, mm-hmm. You know, a couple months ago. And when I asked him point blank, I said, are we in or heading close to World War III? And his answer was, in the eyes of our adversaries, we've been in World War III for a handful of years already, which mm-hmm. is very much aligned with yeah. what you just shared.
Yes, I believe that World War III has already commenced. The starting date, there's some debate for, I hate this term, future historians will have to decide. But I actually think the Third World War really began the moment China popped off their anti-satellite weapon in 2007. I think that was pretty much the beginnings of the great power conflict that's coming. The last 15 or 20 years has been nothing but giant signaling attempts. People need to realize, Everybody says, oh, it's a 1939 moment. Oh, World War II is going to be replicated. We will be lucky if it's World War II. What we're likely going to see is World War I with nuclear weapons and other WMDs, cyber attacks, counter space attacks. And if you remember World War I, you know, spoiler alert for people, it didn't end in a clear cut victory. It was really, if you want to say a victory, it was a Pyrrhic victory at best for the Allies. And it set the stage for an even worse war, World War II. And I think that's where we're headed with a World War III, which has already commenced. And really, it's started in the asymmetrical and unconventional domain, and you're really seeing the great powers. It's really a three-way fight between America and then versus Russia and China. And we're all kind of probing each other for the last 10 to 15 years. It's only going to take one small spark to initiate the conflict. Remember, the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand was viewed dismissively when it happened as the Third Balkan Crisis. It's a minor issue. We have that a similar situation in Ukraine, similar situation in the Middle East, similar situation in Asia between China and Taiwan and North Korea and South Korea. And so any one of those three things is going to spark the world war.
But when you have tensions so high, wars are like riots. They can start by accident.
Absolutely.
You know,
absolutely.
As have many, many times. You just mentioned the biggest example. I want to ask about, you mentioned the Chinese satellite incident in 2007. That's part of a much larger trend that, Dr. Pippa Malmgren calls the hot war in cold places, right?
Yeah.
And this has been occurring for a long time, but because it doesn't bleed, it doesn't lead. And the media doesn't talk about it, because how do you add sensationalism to, infrastructure wars that are happening out of sight and out of mind?
Right.
Now, we talked about the European Parliament website. It was taken down, and a Kremlin-affiliated group raised their hand and said, that was us. Who knows? But the F-35 story is way more interesting because we don't know. And if you think, if that was a hack by some adversary, they wouldn't raise their hand, because that would be an act of war. That's not a website. That's a military aircraft. And so if someone were to raise their hand, they would effectively be saying, shots fired, right? War has begun.
Right.
And if the United States knows that it was hacked, they're not going to acknowledge that they were bested by an adversary publicly. And so, one example closer to Earth that we have, that this battle has been being fought for probably much longer than we acknowledge. How would you describe the concept of the hot war in cold places for somebody who's not familiar, right? I know you cover the space race and you're on top of this. So what's your take, Brandon?
And this has sort of been why I left government, and I've been sort of a public facing person. How do I communicate my concerns to non-experts? I would say that, it's a great question, actually. I should have thought about this further. But I would say that I try to bring it down to our level. So what we were talking about just now, let's talk about my first book, Winning Space. So the opening of my first book is a Russian based space Pearl Harbor. And what does that mean? Well, most of our everyday functions not only rely upon internet, but they rely upon satellites. So think about, Wall Street, $1.3 or $3.1 trillion of electronic trades occur instantly every day. That's made possible by the satellites. You can't purchase your gas at a gas pump if you're using your Apple, pay feature, if you're using your card. You can't purchase gas without those signals crossing the space domain and going back down to Earth to your bank and then relaying it back. You can't phone 911 if you're using your cell phone, which increasingly people, particularly younger people like myself, do not have landlines. We have cell phones. So everything we do relies upon cellular service. Those cell signals on some level are being transmitted through satellites in space. So a degrading anti-satellite attack directed at those constellations could basically prevent communications from occurring, could basically prevent you from phoning your 911 for help if you're under attack, or just calling to check up on grandma and grandpa. This is everyday life, you know, you can't do basic transactions unless you have cash, which increasingly people don't carry cash on them. You can't access your Bitcoin. You can't do things with Bitcoin without having access to your electronic services, which require both internet connectivity as well as satellite reliability. And so all of that is to say that is your everyday existence basically shut down indefinitely until we can do workarounds. And for those people who say, if we lose the satellites, and I know many people who say we have these great undersea cables. The problem is the reason we have satellites is because there's so much bandwidth needed for our modern society. We can't just rely on those undersea cables. And what's more, China and Russia, as well as our military, know where those undersea cables are, and it's very easy to sabotage them and to basically truly render a country deaf, dumb, and blind.
You know, you hit on an event that happened in Canada a couple of years ago when Bell Mobile went down for about a week. And it was never really, there were effectively reasons why put out from Bell. I always wondered what really happened here. But, you know, the point is for, I think, 4 days, Bell Mobile went down, which for people not familiar, what that meant in Canada is that one of the largest cellular companies was not operational. All the internet connections via that platform were down. But more importantly, interact transactions, debit card transactions are powered through Bell. So there were signs up on all stores for like 4 or 5 days, no longer accepting debit. I couldn't access cash via a cash machine or debit transactions. And it was significant because my wife and I were scheduled to go out of town. We have 3 really young kids. Mm-hmm. And I was like, do we leave town if I don't have cell access? I can't call anybody. Nobody can call me. And I don't have access to my bank account. Yep. Like how insecure I felt. And I wanted to call the trip off. You know, we had money in other accounts and it was fine. We ended up going. But how crippled I felt immediately, right? With no explanation or expectation of when this would be resolved.
I live in Florida, and we had on this coast Hurricane Ian. I was about 2 miles away from the eye of the hurricane. I'm still dealing with infrastructure damage. But we were over a week without water and electricity. So I had to go stay. My family and I had to go to a family member's house out of town for that period of time while the city tried to repair our downed infrastructure. It was after day two, it was pretty, I don't know how society could go on. And you have to imagine those people who've lived through a hurricane or been through an event like what you're talking about. Just imagine that for a few weeks or for 6 months or maybe permanently. What do we do? Society grounds to a halt. Everything goes back to a pre-1970s era, if we're lucky. And then meanwhile, people start turning on each other because that happens a lot too.
Obama made a movie about this concept recently. Did you watch that?
Yes, I did. And, it was, some of my friends said it was predictive programming. And I said, I don't know, but, it was pretty accurate. It was almost like he read my book. It was pretty accurate.
All right. Look, I want to I want to pivot a little bit to the China conversation. As I mentioned, there's a handful of directions I want to go with you here. And I think this will kind of follow up as well to your comments on major war coming. So you can make 2 arguments right now about the relationship between the United States and China. And one is that it's becoming increasingly hostile and has become increasingly hostile for the last few years. More recently, you know, President Xi was in San Francisco in October, essentially pitching China, right, to a bunch of business leaders in America. I think trying to drive foreign direct investment, but I'd be keen to know what you thought his motives were. Last month, a bunch of U.S. business leaders were in Beijing for kind of a follow-up, right? My take is like I've heard a bunch of interesting takes, but the one I seem to align with the most is that he's trying to drive investment back into China. I'd love to know your take. Let's start with that. What do you think is behind this activity, Brandon?
He wants investment back in China. There's no doubt. But I have a much more sinister view of him in particular, but his regime. That San Francisco trip was creepy. As an American watching that, the communist flags on the boulevards of San Francisco, the way that suddenly San Francisco was cleaned up overnight. I spent a lot of time in San Francisco. I do a lot of consulting, or I did, with various tech firms in Palo Alto. I for years have gone out to San Fran, and it is not a clean city anymore. No. And suddenly it's like the Chinese emperor's arriving and all of the Mandarins are now cleaning up the avenues and they're welcoming the overlord. It was a very obsequious Gavin Newsom toward Xi Jinping, not one mention of the Uyghurs. You know, Gavin Newsom has no problem going after my state of Florida for COVID related things, but he won't dare challenge the president of China for slaughtering the Uyghurs. It was creepy. As for the Janet Yellen and these people going to Beijing, to me, that was like the, you know, the underlings kowtowing to the Chinese emperor, begging for forgiveness or for good treatment because we are becoming a vassal state to China. I don't believe the Biden administration, despite its rhetoric, really wants to take on China. I think they'd much be happier taking on Russia, for instance, which, you know, it's a threat, but it's not the threat. So my take is you're probably right about seeking investment, but I have a much more sinister view of that whole situation.
And so, okay, so follow-up question then. In 2018, the conversation about U.S.-China relations was largely centered on the trade deficit. We're buying way too much from them. They're not buying anything from us. We need to balance this. Fast forward to 2024, they become one of the largest purchasers of U.S. LNG. And now the conversation is they have way too much leverage over the U.S. economy because they're one of the biggest customers. So you can't have both things, right? But how do you process that, Brandon?
Well, I was never the one saying that we should do more trade with China. I've never supported that. I think it's an insane postulation given the regime over there. And I've written about this extensively. There's actually an article I wrote back in 2019, and I briefed members of Congress based on the article. It was called "Much More Than a Trade War with China." It came out in 2019, and I was talking about how China views trade and how they view trade war and what they do to us and how we basically took it until Donald Trump came along. And then when we started standing up, you sort of had these people popping up in DC saying, you can't do this. I don't believe we should have trade with China. I don't think that we should desire that. I think we need to cut them off and keep them cut off, and do our own thing. And I realize that that would be probably short-term economic damage would be done. But I think in the long term, if you believe as I do that World War III is underway and World War III is going to be truly all of society, you need to indigenously produce and source your own material. And so relying on China, as COVID showed us, for the PPE equipment and for antibiotics and whatnot, having these massive supply chains into China and out of China, having these massive factories in China and not in the United States or not in friendlier countries nearer to our shores, that is a really bad recipe. So I don't think we should be selling LNG at all to China. I think that we should just keep them isolated and cut off as we did the Soviet Union.
Interesting. Okay. Now, President Xi has told his military leadership that he wants them ready for a successful invasion of Taiwan by 2027. He hasn't outright said he's planning on it, but he's told his military leaders he wants them ready for a successful invasion by 2027. What's your take on the weight of that statement?
I think if China decided to pull the trigger either now or in the fall of this year, they would be able to invade successfully Taiwan. I don't think they're going to wait. I think it's very odd. They're saying 2027. Our military officially says that they agree with China, that 2027 is the earliest they could hit. I don't feel comfortable taking my enemies at their word, especially a country like China where the regime lies as a matter of course, to the international community. China, and I've detailed this in a few articles at the National Interest, China right now has the capability, if they really want to do it, to invade Taiwan. Eric Prince has been talking about this, the president or former president of Blackwater. Multiple other parties who are defense officials have been, or former defense officials have been talking about this. They have the capabilities in terms of the civil military fusion to initiate an amphibious invasion right now. And they would likely stand, actually, they'd stand a better chance of taking Taiwan now than they would in 2027. Because 2027 is also when the U.S. military thinks it will have all of the capabilities on hand to deter a Chinese invasion. So China knows this. Why would China wait for America to be stronger? Do it now when America appears weaker. And I think that's what's going to happen soon. I hope I'm wrong and you can have me back on to tell me I'm an idiot. And I'm happy to be an idiot in this one because I don't want this to happen. But I think that China, if they really want to take the island now, they can do it. They don't have to wait till 2027.
Okay. So then you hit on something else that I want to have you elaborate on. That's a, I think, a point of debate in geopolitical circles is, you know, what happens
not
to that?
I'm considered a radical.
What's that?
I'm considered a radical on this issue, so I'm on the outside of this. So
yeah, that's cool. I appreciate the perspective and the debate in the U.S.-China balance is, you know, what will the future unveil? You know, will it unveil a stronger U.S. and a weaker China, or the opposite? Right, and I've heard both points. You seem to be leaning that the time to strike if you're China is now because the U.S. will be better prepared in 3 years. I mean, both countries are facing, you know, economic Absolutely. Challenges right now. China has some pretty serious demographic challenges, yep. but in the course of like 5 years, they're not, I don't know if those materialize.
Exactly. You're right. The longer they wait, the less likely they will be able to do anything they want because of these trends. But those are medium and long-term trends. I was, right. when I was talking to those F-35 guys, I was at a base and there was a larger discussion about China. And one of the things that they kept asking me, these military officials, was about these demographic trends. And you were exactly correct. I told them, I said, if they wait till 2027, if they wait till 2037, they're never going to be able to do it because at that point, they're getting older before they get rich. Their population's declining. They've got economic crises galore. Xi might not still be in charge. You know, there might be an internal, you know, so Xi's not going to wait. He knows this as well. He's not going to wait. He needs to rally around the flag. The best way to do that is to expand a conflict in Asia, which likely would be a Taiwan hit here and now. Also be watching because you see him picking fights right now with the Philippines. I think that's a distraction for us. You see there's a possibility he picks a fight with Japan. I was talking to an expert in China and they said to me, you know, the problem is Taiwan could be very costly and Taiwan could ultimately see Chinese sons who are very valuable in that society, being slaughtered. So a better thing for Xi might be if he needs to rally around the flag to keep his position, you know, powerful, better to attack the Japanese because everybody in China hates the Japanese. So something to consider are the Senkaku Islands, the Diaoyu Islands, as the Chinese call it. That could be a point of conflict as well. And then also you have the ground war. People forget China's trying to become a naval power. They are not yet a true naval power. They are still primarily a continental power. So in 2020, we saw a pretty serious fight break out between them and India over Ladakh province, which is on the Tibetan plateau. It was really over control over Tibetan water rights between India and China. India has the dominant position right now, but China's trying to pick them apart. So that's another point of conflict, but I really believe soon China is going to start a big conflict, in order to rally around the flag. And I really think that we should not just say, well, they have long-term problems. They can't do it now. So they're not going to hit Taiwan. I think that's when they are going to hit Taiwan. You could have said the same thing, by the way, about Japan in 1941. Well, there's, you know, they're not going to hit us just yet. They might try it in a few years. No, they knew that, and they hit us at that point because they knew that our guard was down.
So how do you make how do you reconcile these two things? If China makes a move on Taiwan or the Senkaku Islands in Japan, what's the point of pitching more foreign direct investment? Doesn't that momentum evaporate the minute they land on the shores of Taiwan? Well,
it depends on where you're getting the, I mean, if yes, from the West, it's going to, which is why I'm not really convinced that was the true point of those meetings. it's possible that he wants to ensnare Xi, wants to ensnare as many Western companies as possible. Because basically what happens is, and you know this, I'm sure, you know, Western companies, in order to gain access to China's market share, they have to open up their intellectual property. They have to hand over proprietary technologies and capabilities and knowledge to the Chinese firms they're partnering with. And ultimately, China uses that, folds that information into their indigenous firms, and eventually they create the competition for those Western firms. So it could be that he's trying to do another big push for industrial scale espionage. But that's a great question. I don't really have a good answer for that right now. I don't really think he was really chasing after FDI, though. I'm very skeptical of that. I think this was more him flexing on America. Xi Jinping fundamentally is unlike the last three Chinese leaders. The last three Chinese leaders, they were all communists. They were all anti-American on some level. But the last three Chinese leaders wanted to do trade first and then use the money from that to enhance their military. Xi Jinping is a lot more like Mao. He believes power flows from the barrel of a gun. And so he is much more of the mind of flexing and, you know, beating his chest at his neighbors, even at the expense of his economy. And we see this going on right now in China, where he's handing over relatively productive quasi-private companies in China. He's handing them over to Communist Party apparatchiks that he can control.
Now, okay, so that's interesting. And I find myself wondering about the link between trade and war. And in some ways, they're very linked, and in others, they're not. You know, I think, for example, right now, I'm quite certain the U.S. is importing record amounts of Russian uranium, despite the war, despite the sanctions, all of this. On the surface, we're doing one thing, but trade continues, right? And they're not always as linked as people think they are. There's two other conflicts that I'd love to discuss with you. I'm not sure how deep you are into either. I have a feeling you're quite deep into the Venezuela-Guyana conflict, which I'd love to get your thoughts on. The second, though, is what I'm beginning to call the battle for Africa. So I'm watching the 9 military coups that have occurred on that continent in the last 3 years, and another half dozen of failed attempts. My belief is that these are not grassroots, self-funded operations. They're obviously proxy battles for higher superpowers. Interesting that the Wagner Group, now famous Wagner Group, has been rebranded as Africa Corp, and is parading around the continent offering regime change protection. I mean, if it sounds like an insurance policy, like it is, right? They're offering regime change protection to African countries. So we'll provide military support and intervention if necessary in exchange for, surprise, surprise, great deals on resource extraction. What's your take on the battle for Africa right now, Brandon?
Well, it's definitely happening. I have some friends, Africa scholars, I know too, who are like, well, it shouldn't happen and it's not happening and you're overstating. No, it's definitely happening. And it's all over the natural resources there. All this rhetoric about anti-colonialism and, you know, the Russians and Chinese trot that out. It's not about that. It's about the rare earth minerals. It's about the natural resources there. It's also about the geographical position of Africa. Mm. So, basically, I wrote an article at my website. I don't really write there anymore because I'm too busy. I used to write at my website, theweichertreport.com, and I did a whole article in 2018 or 2017 about how, as America is pivoting to the east or pivoting to the Pacific, China's swinging to their west, and Russia is going to their north and their south. So Russia's going into the Arctic, and Russia's going straight down through Central Asia into Africa, and everybody's kind of meeting in the middle. And so you've got Russia and China both hot and heavy in Africa, much more so than we are. And Russia's using their, as you note, their private military contractors as sort of the tip of the spear. China's using their trade capabilities, the geoeconomic capabilities. But it's all about attaining the natural resources as well as the geographical or fortuitous geographical position. So for China, think about it. They are trying to capture the Indian Ocean. They need to have bases on the east coast of Africa in order to project power not only from the South China Sea into the Indian Ocean basin, but from Africa into the Indian Ocean basin. On the other end of the continent and the African continent, you have also China seeking to build an Atlantic naval base. And that will allow for them to project power, obviously, into the Atlantic. But more importantly, it will allow for them to project naval power into the Caribbean basin, as well as into Latin America, which is America's backyard. For the Russians, they are basically trying to go south in order to gain access to those resources and to prevent the Americans from moving in with their trade and their military deeper into Africa. And so when you mentioned the Africa Corps now, and you mentioned how they are sort of billing themselves as a regime change insurance firm, that is exactly correct, because the Russians have been convinced, and they're not necessarily wrong, that our basically our military, our intelligence services go about fomenting coups in countries that are resource rich to make sure that they remain in our camp. We used to do this all the time during the Cold War, and we never really stopped. I would argue that we probably got less competent at it. And so basically they know that we have let Africa, we've kind of ignored Africa in favor of the Middle East and Asia and now Europe. And so you see Russia acting as this sort of insurance company, protecting anti-American regimes in Africa that are in countries that are resource rich. And you see, by the way, all of the patterns that the Russians are employing in Africa, they're with the former Wagner group, they're applying them also in Latin America. And so Africa is sort of a testing ground for both Russia and China to then take what they learn and how to capture a resource-rich continent like Africa, and they're applying it also to our backyard in Latin America.
Okay, that's interesting. And yes, when I started reading about, you know, the battle for Africa, I kept finding myself thinking, this sounds eerily familiar, like the Soviet US conflicts in Central and South America during the Cold War. Eerily familiar.
Yeah.
And yes, Africa is a supplier of so many necessity commodities, right? Oil, gas, petroleum products, uranium, livestock, produce, agriculture products, fertilizer, you know, these, that's energy and food. It doesn't get more necessary than energy and food when it comes to commodities. So stepping back, your take, who's winning the battle for Africa right now from a power grab standpoint?
Well, I can tell you who's losing. It's Uncle Sam. The United States is losing. Russia and China, it really, at this point, it doesn't really matter who's winning between the two of them, because they are joined at the hip, and Russia is very much the junior partner in the Sino-Russian alliance. And so, you know, we see this in Ukraine explicitly, where Russia is being supplied by China. They're being backstopped by China economically. In fact, there was interesting reports back in 2022, and Newsweek was carrying it at the time, and I think it might have come from Bellingcat, and you have to be careful with some of these private intel firms, because they are kind of co-opted by NATO. But the story was that Putin, in December of 2021, Putin had a two or four hour conversation with Xi Jinping. And according to an FSB whistleblower who basically fled Russia right before the war began and went over to the West, a defector, not a whistleblower, a defector. Basically, this guy was in on a phone call as a translator between Xi and Putin. And in this phone call, Putin, Xi told Putin that if you go into Ukraine in September of 22, we are planning to hit Taiwan. And that is actually the final straw that pushed Putin to say, I'm going to do this, because initially he had some reservations. There were some other issues as well, but that was one of the big ones. Now, ultimately, we know China did not go in to Taiwan in 2022, fall of 2022. But what happened was a very salutary effect. Russia basically severed its ties, and we helped them sever their ties with the West. And that forced Russia to pivot, this resource-rich land of Russia, to pivot and become a junior partner in China's growing Eurasian autocratic empire. And that is what you see now. So when we talk Africa and you see the way the Russians are crawling all over Africa, it really doesn't matter if they're winning over China and America, because they are serving the interests at the end of the day of China.
Right. And just to sort of emphasize how real this is. There's Ukrainian and Russian forces now fighting each other on the ground in Sudan. Right. So, you know, it's
Sudan hasn't had enough problems.
Yeah, truly. Yes. Okay. I want to pivot to that other conflict in South America, the Venezuela-Guyana conflict. Maybe start at a high level, Brandon. What's occurring? Why is it important?
Well, you know, we've had problems with the socialist government in Venezuela for decades since Chavez was in charge. And so that has carried on for many years now. Venezuela is an oil-rich country. There are other commodities there as well that are very important, but oil and natural gas are the big ones. That economy is sclerotic. It is in need of more resources, and they need to basically be able to sell their oil and natural gas, which they are having trouble doing because of our sanctions. And they're always in need of more mineable material. And what happened was their little neighbor in Guyana, it's a very sparsely populated country. There's a large section, I think it might be the size of Rhode Island, on the border of Guyana and Venezuela. It's uninhabited for the most part. Basically, recently they discovered, I think it's one of the largest untapped deposits of oil underneath this area called Esquibo or Esquibio. And basically, Maduro's government in Venezuela, as soon as it was discovered, said, well, actually, that belongs to us. And he cites an old international arbitration agreement between Britain, the British Empire, back, I think, 1893, that basically gave that part of Guyana to the new government of Venezuela. And Maduro's saying that this is ours. And of course, Guyana is recognizing that if Venezuela takes that, their economy is going to be in the doldrums. They need to be able to sell that resource. And basically, Maduro is getting ready to do to Guyana that which Saddam Hussein tried to do to neighboring Kuwait in 1991. And it's getting so serious that the U.S. Navy, for the first time in a long time, has deployed one of its supercarriers off the coast of Venezuela to participate in joint military exercises with Brazil, I think Argentina and Ecuador or Colombia. But basically, there's a multinational Latin American force that is now doing a major military exercise, which is meant to basically signal to Venezuela that we will intervene to stop any invasion of Guyana. And the reason we're doing this is because this was not a planned thing. This is something that we kind of tacked on to at the last minute. It's because our intelligence is indicating that Venezuela is getting ready to do something big into Guyana, and the Guyanese or Guyana will not be able to stop it. By the way, we're already having a crisis at our southern border with Mexico. You know, we have no control over our border. If the shooting war begins, whether we get involved or not, if a shooting war begins with Guyana, it's going to create one of the largest refugee flows in Western Hemisphere history, with millions upon millions of refugees all moving toward the U.S. border. It will be a nightmare scenario for us.
Correct me if I'm wrong, and I very well might be wrong, but the territory in dispute in Guyana, in dispute by the Venezuelans, I should say, that Guyanese are not disputing, they own it, is the majority of Guyana. It's a very large percentage of the country.
It's an insane amount of land. I don't know the exact. Like I said, I think it's like the size of Rhode Island. And what the Venezuelans are also saying is, well, there's not really a lot of people there. Most of the Guyana people live in the capital city, so yeah, you know, it's not a big deal. But of course, you're right. The Guyana government is saying, well, wait a second. If we lose this, we're not going to have an economy. And so, you're right. It's very special.
Yeah, maybe not a lot of people live there, but that's where the resources are. It's like, oh, we'll just take the oil sands from Canada.
Right, exactly.
You can keep Toronto, right?
Yeah.
So the way you describe this, it sounds like an incredibly stacked deck. If the U.S. is there now teaming up with Brazil and Argentina as a show of force, you know, what's the response going to be from Venezuela? That seems like an incredibly imbalanced.
It is. I'm not sold on the fact that the U.S. will intervene. I don't think people overseas, maybe not even in Canada, realize our strategic situation in the United States is very bad. Our defense industrial base is basically broken. We cannot produce submarines. We cannot produce the arsenal of democracy because we shipped all of that capability overseas, notably to China, who is, by the way, a key backer of Venezuela. We've also seen over the last few years, since 2021, a real shift from right-wing pro-American governments throughout Latin America to left-wing anti-American, pro-Russian, pro-Chinese, pro-Iranian governments in Latin America. And so I don't know how reliable even Brazil is. I don't know how reliable Colombia anymore is. You know, there's a real problem here. So I don't really know how dedicated to military response any of these countries would be. And in the case of the United States, we've blown so much of our resources in the Middle East and in Ukraine right now, as we're trying to take on, you know, possibly China with Taiwan. I don't know how significant of a response we could mount.
Right. Yeah. So it might be, we really don't want to, but we could if we had to. So please don't.
Yeah. And I think the Venezuelan government. Yeah, exactly. And I think the Venezuelan government, you know, we talked about this at the beginning. Weakness is provocative, as Donald Rumsfeld used to say, right? Strength deters. The Venezuelans have been watching Washington as closely as Tehran and Pyongyang and Beijing and Moscow have. And, you know, they tried some maneuvers right when COVID hit because they thought America under Trump was too distracted. And Trump ended up sinking a Venezuelan Navy ship, and that ended the whole, you know, threat that was emanating from Venezuela at the time. I think that the Venezuelans are calculating that Biden is not going to do much against them. Also, because Biden has been trying to get a deal with them. He's trying to end the sanctions regime against them. Furthermore, Venezuela is increasingly backed up by China and Russia and Iran and even Turkey, a NATO member. And also Venezuela is looking around at their neighborhood and they're saying, increasingly, we have friendly governments around us, no longer just these anti-Venezuelan, anti-communist, right-wing governments. We now have a lot of friendlier governments also being backed up by China and Russia. And so I think that they're looking around going, maybe the time to do this is now. And if we secure this, we can get Guyana, incorporate that oil resource into our economy, and then the Americans will be forced to be nice to us and play nice with us.
So a few things that you shared today, Brandon, make me wonder about this next question, namely that when it comes to the Venezuela conflict, the United States is not as strategically positioned as the world might assume they are. When it comes to the conflict with China, you know, they're not positioned very well right now. And the time would be now for China to make that move if they were going to. What is your take on the overall longevity of the American empire? Do you think, are you bullish? Are we in the sunset years? What's your perspective on that?
This is a depressing comment because my first book, the subtitle is How America Remains a Superpower. It's amazing how in 5 years, because I finished writing it in 2019, it's amazing how in 5 years the world has changed. America is, you know, when I worked in government, I had an Air Force general tell me, he said that the United States at that point in 2012 was risking becoming a declining great power, a declining great regional power with world or global demands. And I think we are right there. I think we are a great power among other now great powers like Russia and China. And in key areas, maybe not comprehensively, but in key areas like defense industrial production, we are declining. And we see a decline in our political stability at home. We see a decline, despite what the official numbers say. I live in America. I have to buy eggs like everybody else. Our economy is garbage right now. It is horrendous. And it's reminiscent of the Jimmy Carter years, despite what the official numbers say. It's not a good time right now in America. And after 20 years of failed Middle East wars, not actually invigorating our industrial base at home, resisting the Trump administration's attempt to onshore. That was a critical moment, by the way. I think that the United States is no longer an empire for sure. I think we're living in a tripolar era. The works of Randall Schweller and Richard Rosskrantz and several other international relations scholars have shown that in most tripolar systems, they tend to be imbalanced and therefore they always devolve into conflict. And I think that between us, Russia and China, that is where we're headed. And it is because America is in decline. We are not the superpower. And unless we embrace a more realist foreign policy and start actually being strategic, sort of the Elbridge Colby argument, start strategically prioritizing areas and abandoning others, it is going to end very badly for us, as badly as it did for any of the great empires in Europe. And it's going to happen sooner than we think.
Now, in a tripolar or multipolar world, we always descend into conflict. I think about the continent of Europe. It consistently descends into war because there's so many powers sharing one landmass. You know, is that just a consequence of like the prisoner's dilemma? Are you familiar with that analogy a little bit? Yeah. So yeah. Is that why?
Yeah, no, I think so. You know, in our case though, you know, I love that analogy as well. But when I say this to people, they end up telling me, well, Europe was a small geographical area and they were all next to each other. The world's bigger than that and we have oceans. But, you know, we started talking at the beginning of this program about cybersecurity and space defense and things like that. The world has been made smaller. Technology has overcome a lot of the geographical distances. So I think that the world today looks eerily similar to the European continent that went into World War One. And we are basically, and so we are basically in that dilemma. And I think that unless we do a drastic change to our leadership, a drastic change in the way that we view the world, it's going to end in the same kind of nightmare that it did in, you know, from 1914 to 1918 in Europe.
Okay, I'm going to ask you to dig deep now, Brandon. We got to finish on a high note. Because we covered a lot of serious but somewhat dark subjects. What can you pull out from here? So I think about this and I think about, we're descending into a lot of kind of scary culture wars. You know, civil discourse is pretty much absent in our society today, both in the US and in Canada, right? I'm up north of the border, but you know, my wife's American, you know, we're dual. We spend a lot of time down there. But often we see this, right? Right before some kind of a massive transition. And okay, here's the genesis of this question. I sat down with the former Prime Minister of Canada, Stephen Harper, a couple times on this podcast, and I ran through the trajectory of cultural disruption and civil unrest and extremist groups, you know, internally inside the country on either side. And I said, look, Mr. Harper, I can't imagine how we correct course here. It just seems like every year we're going deeper and deeper into our own rabbit holes and less able to cooperate and find any common ground. And what's the end game here? And he said, yeah, it seems really scary, doesn't it? But consider the fact that, Jay, when I was growing up, you know, we went through the exact same thing. We actually ended up with political leaders being assassinated. It got far worse and we came out stronger, right? And it was George Friedman who called this the cycle of American rage. And when we look at the cycles of protests and riots and disagreements, he's like, that's the privilege of democracy, is that we're allowed to get in the streets, right? And fight with each other and find common ground through argument because we're allowed to speak freely and raise our voices. You know, I don't know if there's something there, but it struck me as like, aha, I get it. You know, we go through these cycles. It gets real, real dark. And sometimes it's darkest before the dawn. Sometimes it's darkest before everything goes completely pitch black. I don't know which it is, but what's your take, Brandon?
I love the apocryphal Mal quote there. Yeah, that was good. I like that. Well, the first thing I'll say is my personal belief, I'm a Christian, so I always have hope in my personal life. I'm also a fan of Churchill, and I always have to paraphrase this because I don't think I always get the exact quote right. And it's odd because it's one of my favorite quotes, but he basically said the Americans, do all the wrong things before they finally do the right thing. And I think I'm hoping that this, what we're going through, at least in the United States, and by extension, Canada, I don't mean to remove Canada's agency, but I mean, you know, the trends, they're pretty interconnected here just by dint of geography. I think, we've done a lot of wrong things, especially the last 20 years, really the last, since the end of the Cold War, we've really done a lot of the wrong things. And we've had Clinton, George W. Bush, Obama, and now Biden, who have really kind of continued on a trend of not doing the best or the right thing for the country. And I think now people have had enough, and we're at a generational change. The boomers are dying off. There's a real transition moment happening. And in that transition moment, things are getting very real. And at that point, the survival instinct might kick in and say, you know what, we're going to have to now get serious. And I think that might be how this plays out ultimately. And at the end of the day, then we'll all be fine. What worries me about the George Friedman comment is, I don't believe we have any more real democracy in the United States. I think we have an increasingly totalitarian system that is going after political dissidents. And I'm not even saying this as somebody who necessarily, you know, agrees with what all these political dissidents are saying, but we used to be able to have a conversation in this country. Even if it meant yelling at each other and even maybe throwing things at each other, but at the end of the day, we all could get together on the big issues. Now we don't. And that's partly because of the government interference. And so my hope is, if we can get the domestic situation under control with this upcoming election, and I say this as somebody who's been very critical of former President Trump, I still think between the two men, Trump and Biden, Trump will probably be better for the country than Biden, because Trump is not hemmed in by the status quo thinking that Biden is. In fact, Trump is the anathema to the status quo. We need to get rid of the status quo. So I think if we can get November right in this country's election, I think that's an inflection point. I think we avoid a really bad disaster. I think we avoid locking ourselves into decline and terminal collapse. Things will be better. Things will get better. We'll be on the upswing at that point, maybe slowly, but things will get better. I think if we get November wrong, I think we are the Soviet Union in the late 80s. I think there's no coming out. We cannot survive another 4 years of what we've been going through. That's what I think.
That's really interesting. No, I appreciate that. And your comment about the anathema to the status quo hit me this morning. I was having this internal dialogue discussing, you know, sometimes if you don't know where you need to get to, you don't know exactly where you need to be, but you do know that where you're at isn't where you want to be, right? Step one is move. Like, leave your situation. Right. Even if you don't know which direction to go, leave the situation you don't like. And then you'll begin to get clarity on where you need to go next. But you know where that came from? We talked about these African coups, and a surprising trend in the continent right now is that, according to polls, at present, the majority of young Africans under the age of 35 no longer support the electoral process or the idea of democracy. And when we said, you know, the majority of these military coups were supported by the public, that's what they're saying. They're choosing a military coup that's inevitably going to end up with a dictatorship. But I guess if you lived in like Gabon, for example, and you've had democratic elections for 40 years that have coincidentally elected the same family for as long, like, your idea of democracy is a bit polluted, right? Not the same as mine or yours, right? So of course you just know, I got to leave this situation. I don't care where we go next, but we got to change something.
And to be fair, I think America's demonstration of democracy since the end of the Cold War has been despicable. We went to war in Iraq, WMDs, but as soon as the WMD thing dried up, it became, we went to war to free you and to democratize you. And what ended up happening throughout the Iraq and the Arab Spring was we handed over power to the head choppers. We handed over power to the Islamists. We handed over power to Iran. And so the world watched that and they said, we don't want that. The Russians are a great example of this mentality as well. In the 90s, in my new book that's coming out in October, A Disaster of Our Own Making, How the West Lost Ukraine, I have an entire section in there detailing how actually The Russians in the 90s were sincere, including at one point Vladimir Putin to some degree, were sincere about opening up Russia. And they stopped and went against it because of the what they perceived to be the failures both of democracy and capitalism in Russia in the 90s. And if you look at Russia in the 90s, you cannot say it was a success story for democracy or capitalism. Similarly, in China, you know, I don't believe if there is to be an internal revolution against Xi or even the Communist Party, I don't believe for a second that any democracy is going to arise there, because the people in China, they may not like the Communist Party, but they also have a very dim view of democracy, because they look at America and they say, you guys can't get your elections right. You go around the world in imperial fashion. And whether that's true or not is irrelevant. It's what they believe. And so I think that explains why you're seeing throughout the global South, a negative reaction to democracy among the very young people who normally would say, we want democracy. Mm.
Yeah. Okay. I can't argue that. Look, Brandon, I know we're bumping up against your clock here, so I want to thank you for coming on the show and point people. Where should I send them? You do have another book coming out, A Disaster of Our Own Making, How the West Lost Ukraine. When's that coming out? When can we expect
it's
that?
It's coming out from Encounter Books. It's coming out October 22nd. It'll be available wherever books are sold. I always tell people, for all my books, you can get them at a bookstore, but unfortunately, brick and mortar stores are going away more and more. So probably just go online, Amazon, BarnesandNoble.com, you know, anywhere there's books sold. And then you can follow me on Twitter. I have a pretty hostile presence, I was told at times. So just be aware, at We the Brandon. And then I am also a national security and defense analyst at the National Interest, as well as an energy security analyst at thepipeline.com.
All right. At We the Brandon. All right, Brandon, I appreciate you today.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming on the show. Love to do it again sometime. Yeah. We'll revisit some of these theses maybe 6 months
down the
road.
Tell me how wrong I am.
See how we're doing. All right. Thanks again, man.
Thank you.
If you enjoy my content, do me a favor. Follow or subscribe to this podcast. Drop me a rating and a review and share this with a friend. All of these things allow me to get bigger and better guests on the show. Now you can catch me all over social media at JMartinBC. Thanks for tuning in.